Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. I found something on YouTube today. It's a tape of President John F. Kennedy on the evening of June 11th, 1963, giving the nation his civil rights speech. Now, as JFK speeches go, this is not a number one hit like Ich bin ein Berliner or Ask Not What Your Country Can Do for You, but man, it should be.
It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. Now the time has come for this nation to fulfill its promise.
A few hours after JFK offered this stirring speech, the civil rights activist Medgar Evers was assassinated. Those are two of the events that inspired trumpeter and composer Wadada Leo Smith, whose huge piece called 10 Freedom Summers was a finalist for this year's Pulitzer Prize in Music. He'll join us to talk about it. Also, live music from singer-songwriter John Grant, Colorado-born but living in Iceland. But first, that's the late singer Jeff Buckley, whose career was on a steep upward trajectory when he drowned in 1997 at the age of 30. Buckley had an amazing voice. He also had musical genes because he was the son of Tim Buckley, a cult singer-songwriter of the early 70s who overdosed at the age of 28. They are the subject of the new movie Greetings from Tim Buckley. It stars Penn Badgley, who you may know from his role in Gossip Girl, here playing Jeff Buckley. The movie opens on Friday. Penn Badgley, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
So, big shoes for you to step into, the singer Jeff Buckley. Even though you're sort of portraying him at a point when he's a relative unknown,
how
were you a fan?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I think anybody who's musical and even far beyond that category of people, I mean, he's somebody who I don't run into people often who don't have a special place on the shelf for him, you know what I mean? It's very easy to respect him and admire him and kind of mythologize him in a way. I was a huge fan for a period when I was a teenager. I loved his Live at Chennai albums.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those blew me away. I mean, just him in a Telecaster with, like, you know, clean tone, a little bit of reverb, playing. In fact, the first track where it really blew me away, and I started to think, who the hell is this kid? Was Strange Fruit, his cover of Strange Fruit, you know? So, like, you have this young white guy in the 90s singing Strange Fruit,
yeah.
and it felt more relevant and soulful than ever. It was just so achingly beautiful and also ballsy. I mean, you know, he's taken on Nina Simone and Billie Holiday and Dylan and Van Morrison, and I mean, he just slayed for a couple of years, you know? And that Chennai album is like, he's like an athlete, you know?
Yeah.
At the top of his game.
For folks who weren't around in New York at the time, Chennai was this tiny little club in Lower Manhattan where he would go.
It was like a coffee shop,
exactly. Yeah, and it's kind of like where he got some of his first renown. Let's hear this recording that Penn's talking about. Jeff Buckley singing Strange Fruit live at Chennai.
Southern tree, bear strange fruit, blood on the leaf, and blood at the root, a black body swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree. pastoral singing of the gallant sound of the bulging hours and the twisted mouth.
That is the late Jeff Buckley singing Strange Fruit from the album Live at Cheney. We're talking with Penn Badgley, who plays Jeff Buckley in the new film Greetings from Tim Buckley. Although Penn is best known for playing the role of Dan Humphrey on the CW television series Gossip Girl, which ended past December, this new film comes out on Friday, May 3rd, is currently available on video on demand. Jeff Buckley, the son of Tim Buckley. Mm-hmm. We can talk in a moment about the kind of fraught relationship they had. But all right, we get to hear Jeff's singing voice there. Was it daunting for you as a fan, as an aspiring singer yourself? I mean, had you sung before into this?
You know, I'd grown up singing. I'd grown up loving and playing music in a way that I think is. I mean, as much as I loved it, it's sort of strange I never pursued it, and it's because I started acting at such a young age. So yes, it was very daunting because not only did I have to step into his giant shoes. But I was, you know, there was pressure that I was putting on myself just because I always wanted to explore the musical element. And then, you know, my first time exploring it is like being captured and having to emulate somebody like Jeff. So it was daunting. It was alternately super daunting and then kind of like so incredible that it was inspiring. You know, I wasn't really even thinking about that. I think more than anything, I was aware of the karmic weight of playing somebody who's dead just from one human to another, you know what I mean? Like on a very simple but deep level. I was very aware of that while we were shooting. So, it wasn't just a voice.
Yeah, so it wasn't just, oh, all these Jeff Buckley fans are going to hear me singing this and they're going to think, oh, he doesn't sound like Buckley.
Yeah, right. And I was aware of that. I mean, that's definitely, and I don't, you know. I mean, even the moments where I do him justice, I'm still not even close to what, you know, his quality was, it wasn't just his range. Like, there are a million people with range, you know. I mean, I actually have range, but the quality is just, he had this lightning, this electricity in his voice, you know. And that's for him to, that's for his.
Right.
And I think it's really appropriate that we chose to do what we did, which is me singing it all live. So it just has this kind of raw, you know, as much of that electricity as we can like kind of recapture. You know?
Yeah. And there's one scene in the film where Jeff is trying to impress the intern, his love interest, where you have to sing a Led Zeppelin song a cappella. What was that like?
Well, that was actually one of the most fun parts of the film. I remember when I read that scene, it was, you know, I saw this strange moment that Dan, the director and writer, had captured, and he understood Jeff's voice somehow. Like Jeff, you know, he was this like famous mimic, and you know, he would screech and do all these. I mean, he would like, his vocal acrobatics were, you know, only the half of it, because he had an encyclopedic memory of music. And there's no way to rehearse that. There's no way to prepare it. I happen to know the songs as well. So we did three takes of the scene and just tried to get it all out. You know?
Right there in the record store.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'm telling you now, the greatest thing you ever could do now is share a smile with someone who's blue now. Cause I love you, baby. How I love you, darling. Oh, I love you, baby. My mama, a little girl, a little girl. Since I love you, I would like to live a whole century.
Penn Badgley displaying some hitherto secret vocal chops in the film called Greetings from Tim Buckley. So, Penn, you're playing Jeff Buckley. Imogen Poots plays Allie, his love interest. And you're kind of cycling through three or four different tracks from the third Led Zeppelin record there.
It's just this mishmash of things. It was like, you know, in any given moment when I would just kind of forget what I was doing, I'd just like go into the Robert Plant, like, yeah, you know, and yeah, in fact, they, I don't know if Dan, the director, would want me to tell you this, but
it's just you and me, but, a couple of microphones, what could happen? Yeah,
but like from the first to the third take, he basically would come back and be like, that's great, just sing less of the songs themselves, because, you know, I think initially it was a rights issue.
Right. Well, you know, that sort of explains, I think, why we don't hear actually Jeff Buckley's songs.
Right.
I mean,
yeah,
there's a little hint of grace.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, you know, there are, I guess, competing biopics about Jeff Buckley in the works, one of which is the family is working
on.
Yeah,
of course. And yeah, we don't have the rights to his voice or his music or anything. But I think what has proven to be really interesting about that for us is that it was a blessing all along. It was a blessing in disguise. You know, when I first read the script, I definitely didn't understand why the Jeff Buckley movie was called Tim Buckley. You know,
like, greetings from Tim Buckley. Yeah.
Yeah, greetings from Tim Buckley. But getting to know these men as much as I could, you know, I started to realize how appropriate it was, this telling of their lives together and apart, and the way that we're getting at their art, you know, their sort of strangeness, their ethereal vibe. I mean, not using Jeff's music is in some ways the best way to get at him, because, you know, he wasn't really a typical writer. He wasn't a typical artist and musician the way people think of him. You know, they mythologize him as this, like, sort of ethereally talented Bob Dylan type, but he really was much more in the vein of a Nina Simone or Billie Holiday, where he's interpreting brilliantly, unlike anyone else. You know, I mean, in the end, I think he only wrote a handful of songs.
Right.
Like,
right.
And a lot of them are co-written in a way that I think, you know, would surprise some people, mm-hmm. because his ability, his talent as a musician was so wide, you know, like gaping wide. It's just this endless hole of talent that he never knew how to shape, you know what I mean?
The film begins, Greetings from Tim Buckley, with the Arts at St. Anne's, the Brooklyn concert organizer, presenter, calling Jeff Buckley to say, we would like you to take part in this tribute to your dad.
Yeah.
And perhaps they're taken aback, although why would they be? You know, if they had done a little homework, they might have realized Jeff Buckley doesn't have any real connection to his dad, Tim Buckley.
What we weren't able to fit in the film, but what is true, is that they were aware, and Jeff had sent them a demo, and Hal Willner, who was organizing the whole thing, the producer, creative musical director of Saturday Night Live and all sorts of things. He was like this figurehead of the counterculture LES scene at that point. He is quoted as saying, like, it was just kind of noisy, you know, it was just this noise. And Jeff was an out-of-work session guitarist in L.A. whom no one knew could sing, you know. And he had this kind of punk rage in him. But he was also very quiet and shy and, like, really, really sensitive and insecure. So he comes to New York, and we pick up basically right there. And it's the strange wonder that was Jeff's meteoric rise, because in some ways, he was a little bit of a late bloomer. Like, nobody knew, including Jeff to some degree, like, what was inside of him.
Hmm.
And this story is like the 4 to 5 days where all of a sudden the world, in a, you know, just in a small way, is starting to recognize, like, who the hell is this guy?
And in recognizing Jeff Buckley, there's the constant, oh, he's Tim Buckley's
son. Right, exactly, which is even more eerie, because Tim was such a, even though a very different kind of musician, he was a similar icon of his respective generation.
Right.
And these two men are, like, eerily similar in ways that is very rare, you know, with a father and son. But then they are father and son, and then on top of that, they never knew each other.
Right, so Jeff has to work through not only his own coming of age, but coming to terms with all these people suddenly piling the daddy baggage
right.
on top,
and I think in his eyes at this point he's like, well, I don't think about my dad. I'm not worried about him. Like, you know, screw that guy. I'm not.
We're speaking with Penn Badgley. Here he is as Jeff Buckley with Imogen Poots as the love interest, Allie. They're on a train discussing Jeff Buckley's complicated feelings for his father, Tim.
My father was a total phony.
Did you know him?
Yes.
Did you know?
Yes,
him?
I knew him.
No, did you actually, like, meet him?
I met him twice, actually. Once when I was 1 year old, he dropped on my birthday to give me a rattle. How's that? And then second time I was 8 years old, he invited me to come see him perform the Troubadour. It was his wife, actually, invited me to come stay at their house for 3 weeks, which I did, and I never saw him. I didn't see him once. Why?
That is the voice of Penn Badgley playing Jeff Buckley, the late singer, in the new film Greetings from Tim Buckley, which opens at the Village East on Friday, May 3rd, currently available on video on demand. And Penn, that fraught relationship is that's kind of the main melody, if you will.
It is, yeah. I mean, I think it's going to surprise people because it's not so much a biopic as it is a meditation on this father and son relationship, yeah. more than anything else.
But there is the big dramatic moment of this concert, you know, which has been the driving force of the whole story here, where Jeff is going to take part in this tribute concert to his late dad, Tim Buckley. That was actually shot. I mean, you guys actually did a concert?
We did. We did a full concert. I think the concert ended up having a running length of about an hour. And the way we did it is that for all the extras watching, of which I think there were like 300 of them, roughly, there were no pauses. So like in between setting up shots, the musicians, the incredible band, I mean, they were all like really wonderful. And some of them were actually at the show, the original show, like Gary for one. And then
Gary
also,
Lucas, yeah.
Hank Roberts, who is a cellist, mm-hmm. a really talented cellist. So they would create these soundscapes while we were setting up different shots, and then we'd go right into songs. So it was a seamless experience for everyone involved, and we just ran through the concert, I think, 2.5 times, from like, 1 in the morning till 4 or 5, and so it's real, and it's all played all live, we captured it live, and it was kind of a mess like it was.
original concept.
Yeah, yeah.
So you are playing Jeff, who is covering Tim in this song called Once I Was. This, again, is from the film called Greetings from Tim Buckley. That's my guest Penn Badgley performing as Jeff Buckley, the role of the late singer in the new film Greetings from Tim Buckley, and that's Jeff singing a song by his dad called Once I Was. I gotta say, Penn, that first note that you hit, that sounds like Jeff.
Thank you, man.
That sounds like Jesus. Jeff Buckley.
That's what we want to hear. That was the first time I'd sung it out loud.
Hmm.
Which is a really weird choice to have made. and here's the crazy, like, I hadn't thought about it. I just kept putting it off in my head. I was like, I'm going to save it. And somehow, because I was so busy, everyone was trusting, like, yeah, well, he's rehearsing his ass off, you know what I mean? And I was rehearsing in the sense that I was just living in a way that I think was preparing me very much for it, so it's not even mental, but emotional and kind of creative. But yeah, man, I mean, that whole concert and that, yeah, it was like, it was intense. It was super intense. And Gossip Girl just kept me kind of busy.
Yeah.
So I couldn't
overthink it.
Scare myself.
Yeah. More music in your future, do you think?
Certainly. I mean, whether it ever goes public is another thing. But it's always been my first passion. And now there's some space and time to work and write. I mean, the truth is, you look at a musician like Jeff, he was diligent. Like a diligent self-taught, guitar virtuoso. He puts the time in. Anybody who's a real musician puts the time in. I just need to put the time in.
All right. Well, we will get to hear and see Penn Badgley in the role of Jeff Buckley beginning on Friday, May 3rd. The film Greetings from Tim Buckley opens at the Village East. It is currently available on video on demand. Penn Badgley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. If a
another performance from Penn Badgley is Jeff Buckley with the house band from the new film Greetings from Tim Buckley. Up next, singer-songwriter John Grant plays in our studio, and later, trumpeter and composer Wadada Leo Smith on his epic jazz piece, 10 Freedom Summers, about the civil rights struggle. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The music world is full of singer-songwriters who draw on their own lives for source material, and when we think of these confessional musicians, we tend to think of a sensitive New Age guy gently plunking at a guitar. Then there's John Grant, who has never been shy about wrestling with his demons in his songs, but is doing so now to an electronic dance groove. This tune is called Sensitive New Age Guy, and while there may be a wink behind the title, there are some big issues at play in John Grant's new record, Pale Green Ghosts. He's here with his band to play some of those songs for us live, beginning with a song called GMF. This is John Grant on Soundcheck.
Probably say I'm difficult. I probably talk too much. I overanalyze and overthink things. Yes, it's a nasty crutch. I'm usually only stop talking so that I can. Concerning two-way streets, I have to say that I am not a fan. But I am the greatest living creature you are ever. From the top of my head down to the tips of the toes on my feet. So go ahead and love me while it's still a crime. Don't forget you could be laughing 65% more of the time. You could be laughing 65% more of the time. Time I think I'm in some movie. I play the underdog, of course. I wonder who they'll get to play me. Maybe they could dig up Richard Burton's corpse. I am not who you think I am. I am quite angry, which I barely can conceal. You think I hate myself, but it's you I hate, because you have the nerve to make me feel. But I am the greatest living creature you are ever gonna meet. From the top of my head
sabbaticals on my feet. So go ahead and love me while it's still a crime. Don't forget you could be laughing 65% more of the time. You could be laughing 65% more of the time. I should have practiced my scales. I should not be attracted to males. But you said that I should learn to love myself. Well, make up your mind, Dr. Frankenstein. The top of my head down to the tips of the toes on my feet. So go ahead and love me while it's still a crime. Don't forget you could be laughing 65% more of the time. 'Cause I am the greatest living creature you are ever gonna meet. From the top of my the toes on my feet. So go ahead and love me while it's still a crime. Don't forget you could be laughing 65% more of the time. You could be laughing 63% more of the time. You could be laughing 25% more.
That is John Grant and his band live in the Soundcheck studio. The song on the record called GMF, this live version we'll call Greatest Living Creature. The album is called Pale Green Ghosts. It comes out on May 14th. We're getting a bit of a preview of it from John Grant and the ensemble here in the studio. John, first of all, thank you for doing a radio-friendly version of that song for us.
Well, it's my pleasure, John. When I was asked to do a radio-friendly version, I was a little bit reluctant because I don't want to, of course, nobody ever wants to change their lyrics, but I thought, you know, I would really like to have it on the radio because mm-hmm. I really like the song, and I thought if I can come up with something that I think is good mm-hmm. enough
right.
to replace it, then I'll do it, and I think this works. So
GMF, G is for greatest, MF is for one of those phrases the FCC prefers us not to use on the air.
Yes.
It becomes greatest living creature here.
Yeah, and that's just as absurd, so I like that.
Now, you were part of the alternative rock scene back in the 90s with the Czars.
Yes.
It's a long journey to where you are now. I mean, and I don't mean that literally because you're living in Iceland. I mean musically to the kind of stuff that you've been doing as a solo artist in recent years.
Yeah, it's true. Although it's not as long of a journey as many people would think. I mean, those that are close to me know that my favorite thing is the music that I fell in love with in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So electronic-based music has always been my favorite thing. This album is rooted firmly in the 80s. It's about my adolescence. It just worked out that way.
Now, were you aware of who you were as an adolescent? Did you feel different growing up gay in Colorado? And
I did. I mean, for me, it was... I think this might have something to do with my love for movies like The Fly and American Werewolf in London, and horror movies in general, because, you know, I noticed this metamorphosis taking place inside of me that was an extremely negative thing and something that simply could not be, and I was unable to stop it. And so for me, it was a horror movie, you know, because, you know, I grew up in an atmosphere where, you know, being gay simply wasn't an option, and it was something that needed to be corrected with psychological,
right.
with treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that led to a lot of neuroses in me.
So, Yeah, I think you told the Guardian in London it would have been better to be a drug addict than to be gay. And,
yeah, that's how I felt. I felt like it would have, you know, like
so
other
you went
people
and did both.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I thought I'll check both of those boxes.
Yeah. We're speaking with John Grant, whose new album is called Pale Green Ghosts. Where does that title come from?
That refers to the trees that lined certain sections of the highway in Colorado, I-25, that I spent a huge portion of my life driving up and down while different things were happening. And these trees are called Russian olive trees, and they're considered, they're sort of unwanted by many people, considered a weed or something. But they have these beautiful pale green leaves on them that have a silvery back to them, and so they're sort of luminescent in the moonlight. And at the end of May, they get these tiny little yellow flowers on them, and then they release the most incredible fragrance, for me personally, that I've ever smelled. And I connected that to a little oasis of time in the 80s when I was driving up and down this highway, and I had I was driving an Oldsmobile Firenza that I got from my older brother, and I was on my way to Boulder. Over the course of about a week, I remember this, you know, crappy AM radio I had in the car. I found this station accidentally that was only playing the sound of the ocean. Whoa. So I just remember, you know, it being late spring. It's getting really warm in Colorado. The windows are down. And they got that late spring warm wind blowing in my hair, and the sound of the ocean coming out on the radio, and the smell of those pale green ghosts along the highway. And that's something that that was a really beautiful moment for me in time. So I wanted to try and, you know, capture it and destroy it.
I was just going to say. So it wasn't all a horror movie for you.
No, it wasn't. No, there were great times too. Especially the music that I loved during that period.
Right. Did you listen to Sinead O'Connor back then?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, on that road to the club that I was going to in Boulder, that is where I first heard Mandinka,
her first
Lion
hit,
and the Cobra.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, Sinead O'Connor, apparently a fan of yours, having covered your song, Queen of Denmark.
Yeah, and she's become a good friend. You know, mm-hmm. She's become somebody that I consider a close friend. And, I didn't see that one coming.
Yeah. No. Well, now she's all over singing backup vocals on the new record.
Yes.
So how did that happen?
Well, she was in London. We were in London at the same time. And she was doing the Graham Norton show that night and asked me if I wanted to come along. And so I went over to her hotel beforehand, and she asked me if I had any demos from the new record. And I was horrified, of course. Sinead O'Connor, you're hanging out with her. You know, and you're like, all right, I passed muster with Queen of Denmark, but now she wants to hear my new stuff, and what if she hates it, you know? And anyway, I played her It Doesn't Matter to Him, and right after the first couple of lines, she took off the headphones and she said, I'm singing on your album.
Then I guess she was singing on your album.
Yeah,
if
I didn't
argue
with her.
She says it is so, you know, it is so.
That's right.
All right, John Grant, the new album is called Pale Green Ghosts. It comes out on May 14th, but John is here with his band. You want to do Vietnam for us next?
I'd love to.
All right, let's hear another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. The song is called Vietnam. John Grant singing, playing some keyboards. The rest of the band, we've got a studio littered with keyboards here, in fact, performing live for us on Soundcheck.
To say that I'm a man undone is understatement at its worst. I was completely incapacitated by your southern charm. It hit me like an ancient gypsy curse. But this instrument you use with such precision is like a concrete wall 1,000 meters tall. And I've tried to climb its icy walls 1,000,000 times, but I simply cannot find inside of me the requisite resolve. Your silence is a weapon. It's like a nuclear bomb. It
It's like the Agent Orange they used to use in Vietnam. And it's accompanied by an apathy that's deafening to the ears. You know it is complete and perfect, and you wield it with our feet. Don't care. You attacked me by not saying anything. You say that you don't bring your anger to me, but it poisons every fiber of your being. Now you've started something that you cannot finish, and left me standing in the wreckage on my own. And the only thing that brings me any comfort is the knowledge that no matter who you're with, you'll always be. Silence is a weapon. It's like a nuclear bomb. It's like the Agent Orange they used to use in Vietnam. And it's accompanied by an apathy that's deafening to the ears. You know it is complete and perfect, and you wield it without fear. Silence is a weapon. It's like a nuclear bomb. It's like the Agent Orange they used to use in Vietnam. And it's accompanied by an apathy that's deafening to the ears. You know it is complete and perfect, and you wield it without fear.
That is John Grant and the band live on Soundcheck, and another song from the forthcoming record Pale Green Ghosts. That one is called Vietnam. And so, John, Vietnam's the title, but of course the song is not about Vietnam.
No, no, it's not.
Any more than the song Ernest Borgnine is about the late actor Ernest Borgnine.
Ernest Borgnine happens to be one of my cinematic heroes. And I did happen to meet him once when I was working as a waiter at Gramercy Tavern here in Manhattan, and he was doing a luncheon in the private dining room for his new autobiography. And when he left, I got to shake his hand and meet him, and I was really, that was a highlight for me.
So that line in the song, that's like ripped right out of the diary, your diary.
Yeah, I mean, it's about the absurdity of, you know, of escaping from everyday life. You know, I'm talking about my HIV diagnosis in the song, and you know, grappling with the psychological element of that and how it affected me. And, you know, when it becomes too much, I wonder what my hero, Ernest Borgnine, would do.
I was wondering why that line, I have the disease, was woven into this particular song, but that's a really good reason to do it if it, you know, kind of...
You know, it's about, you know,
persevering.
Persevering and also me sort of forgiving myself for allowing that to happen to me. And I had a lot of, you know, like I said, it was a psychological, you know, labyrinth, of course, that one, coming to terms with that. And, you know, I was very, very, very angry at myself for allowing it to happen. But I decided, you know what, man, you've been giving yourself so much crap for so many decades. Why don't you cut yourself a break and move on, you know?
Well, John, it has been a real pleasure having you here with us in our New York studio.
Thank you, John.
Looking forward to hearing the record. The release is May 14th. John Grant with us on Soundcheck. Coming up next, the composer and trumpeter Wadada Leo Smith on the civil rights struggle and his epic piece called 10 Freedom Summers. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The trumpeter and composer Wadada Leo Smith has spent more than 40 years surprising listeners. He's known as a proponent of free jazz, but he's also played world music, done a tribute album to Miles Davis's Electric Period, and was named this year as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Music for this work called 10 Freedom Summers. It's a huge 4-hour-plus piece inspired by the civil rights movement, and it brings Wadada Leo Smith to our Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
How you doing, John?
Good. So there's a lot of music here. Over 4 hours. When did you start this project?
In 1977, at a request from Leroy Jenkins.
The violinist.
The violinist and composer. In the back of my head or on the left or right side, I'm constantly thinking about what can I do regarding this movement of human rights in America. And growing up in the South, you know, you're always looking for how you can do something.
Mm.
So I decided that, all right, I would take something that's very close to my heart and just write about it, which was Mega Evers.
Well, now, you made some choices in 10 Freedom Summers that I think are pretty obvious. You mentioned Medgar Evers, Emmett Till, Martin Luther King, the Freedom Riders.
Right.
You made other choices that were not so obvious. There's a piece called John F. Kennedy's New Frontier and the Space Age,
yes,
1960.
Yes. Why? Well, let's say it this way. John F. Kennedy was the first president that actually made a spontaneous appeal for civil rights. On that same night, Medgar Evers was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
But I put John F. Kennedy there because of that speech that he made. At the end of his speech, it was completely improvised. It wasn't part of the actually written text, okay? So I put him there, and all of my pieces are short frame moments because I'm looking for the psychological connection that I can make as a human being with that event or with that particular person and try to frame it so that it's not too big and that it's small enough that I can clearly point to and say, this is what that is.
So you're dealing with such big ideas, you need to have those moments that you can point to so that people sort of can wrap their heads around it.
Yes, every piece is constructed like that.
Let's hear a little bit from Wadada Leo Smith's massive work called 10 Freedom Summers, which has been released as a 4-CD set. This is a little bit of John F. Kennedy's New Frontier and the Space Age, 1960. That is music from Wadada Leo Smith, my guest on Soundcheck. It's called John F. Kennedy's New Frontier and the Space Age, 1960, part of the larger, much larger piece called 10 Freedom Summers, written over, my math is going to fail me here, but something like 35 years.
Yes.
Wadada Leo Smith, obviously here with us in the Soundcheck studio, named as a finalist for this year's Pulitzer Prize in Music for this recording, the 4-CD set of 10 Freedom Summers. So, it was intended from the get-go to, as you said, you grew up in the South, you lived through many of these events. Mm-hmm. This was intended as a kind of
my contribution,
marker, yeah, to that conversation about civil rights,
yes,
human rights.
Yes. But I decided I would do it without words because there's a certain kind of abstractness that allows a lot of people to imagine or reimagine their relationship to it.
Hmm.
One coincidence that did occur in the recomposing of this music and finishing of it was that the first piece was Medgar Evers and the last piece was JFK.
Hmm.
So that's a really, I didn't and plan it that way.
Because Medgar Evers, again, was killed on the night that JFK
exactly,
made that,
exactly.
that famous speech. So in terms of the construction, I mean,
mm-hmm.
how much composition versus improvisation, how much notation is there in this work?
Well, in JFK, there's very little improvisation. In fact, JFK, there's no improvisation except slight moments in the piano. Okay.
Have you worked like that before?
Yes, I have. I all my life I have.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked like that because when I was coming up, there was constant this idea about being a composer. I started composing when I was 12. I didn't ask anybody, could I study with them or could I compose? I just simply started composing.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, I did not know all of the notes when I started composing. But I wrote every note that I possibly could in that first piece for three trumpets. And I got to school, and the next few days, the two other buddies and I laid it out, got the book with the fingerings in it. We play up until we got to a note we didn't know the fingers. Then we would find the fingering of it and play the note.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I got started. So...
Wow, so, see, you so guys were punk rock before there was punk rock.
yeah.
So in terms of, you know, you've developed a kind of your own system of notation
yes,
for many of your pieces.
Yeah.
Are the 10 Freedom Summers works in that system, or are they sort of conventionally notated?
It's notated conventionally, but there's no counting. There's no beating. I frame it in certain kinds of ways with brackets that tell how it should be broken up.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the performers would not know how to play it unless I'm there to explain something to them.
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting at here, is how much of a repeatable experience this piece is. It's being done here tomorrow night and Friday night at Roulette, and, you know, it's you will be there, but at some point in the fullness of time, you won't be there, and right. What will this piece be at
this
that point?
This piece will be able to be played by any good ensemble.
Okay.
And it also can, my Golden Quartet, which is only four people, play the entire score when we cannot have the full ensembles in the performance. And it just, guess what? It sounds just like JFK.
Well, you know, emotionally it goes through, sonically it's almost orchestral range.
It is, yes.
And emotionally, you know, it's got very fraught moments, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. But there are also moments of like real serenity, almost.
Yeah.
Which is not maybe something we associate with the civil rights movement.
Well, you wouldn't, but for example, the piece that strikes me most in that notion of serenity is Emmett Till. And it has captured this kind of element of beautiness of being sad and joyous at the same time. And I tried to capture that photograph of him in the white hat, that youthful face, kind of peacefully looking out at everybody. And I contrasted with this historical knowledge about his how he was beaten to death.
Mm-hmm.
And for some unknown reason, when the piece was over, I didn't know that I had captured that until we did it in the rehearsal.
Wow.
And everyone felt it in the rehearsal. Everyone felt it. They said, this piece is sad and it's happy. That's very unusual.
Let's hear a little bit from Emmett Till. This is one of the iconic moments in the civil rights movement, as captured in the piece 10 Freedom Summers by my guest Wadada Leo Smith. That's a little bit of Emmett Till from 10 Freedom Summers, finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Music this year, from my guest Wadada Leo Smith, the trumpeter and composer. 10 Freedom Summers has been released on a 4-CD box set and is being performed live at Roulette here in New York and in Brooklyn, actually. Tomorrow night, May 2nd, Friday night, May 3rd. By the Golden Quartet and numerous friends and colleagues.
Yes, the Pacific Ray Choral is the ensemble.
Now, the civil rights movement, which inspired your piece, 10 Freedom Summers, we associate that with a certain kind of music, you know, with certain musical figures, whether it's Mahalia Jackson or Pete Seeger or, you know, songs like, you know, Wade in the Water and things like
that. Or Harry Belafonte.
Okay, So were you kind of playing against type with this piece?
Not really. I was trying to break tradition, okay? And the tradition is that they often would leave out this kind of complex music involved around that movement. And I know why they did it. They did it because the movement itself come out of the church. And the church usually has a way of keeping this world round. They didn't want any square in the round box. And I don't fault them for it, because when you look across, there's John Coltrane. There are a number of jazz artists that have actually made pieces towards the civil rights movement. And they've been usually those that are most kind of advanced, you see. So that music had not been taken into, let's say, that arena as protest music or music around that idea.
Yeah, it would have been protest music. You wanted everybody, whether they had musical training or not, to be able to sort of get involved and stuff. So what were your musical inspirations for 10 Freedom Summers?
Well, the largest is of course, Duke Ellington, Black, Brown, and Beige, which was about essentially the same thing.
And Max, which was a composed piece.
It was a composed piece.
Yeah.
Max Roach, Freedom Now.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, Anthony Davis, Malcolm X.
Oh, yeah.
There's a number of people, but the structure that it took come from August Wilson, the playwright.
The playwright.
August, yes,
yeah.
Yes. Because he looked at a century, 10 decades of African-American experience in America. I, incidentally, my trumpet was heard on the first performance in Black Bottom as part of that opening when it opened at Yale Repertory Company in New Haven, Connecticut.
Really?
Yes.
It was live music in the
It wasn't
the
live. It was recorded.
Oh, okay.
Dwight Andrews had orchestrated the music from Fletcher Henderson, those guys.
Yeah.
And I was one of the people that played it. So there's a coincidence, again, that connects it together. But I decided that I would look at 10 summers, just like he had looked at 10 decades. And so that's the real structural connection. I've seen three of those plays, you know.
And what's the, there's an overall title to those.
The Pittsburgh Cycles.
Yeah, the Pittsburgh Cycle.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one of the sources of inspiration behind this inspiring work by Wadada Leo Smith called 10 Freedom Summers, a finalist for this year's Pulitzer Prize in Music. Performances at Roulette in Brooklyn tomorrow and Friday night. Wadada, we're going to wrap up with a little bit of America, Parts 1, 2, and 3, which suggests this conversation's not over. It continues.
Exactly.
It has been great having this conversation with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, John.
This is Soundcheck. That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, before the 17-year cicadas emerge this spring, we'll talk with writer, musician, and philosopher David Rothenberg about the connection between human music and insect noise. Plus, classical pop and R&B all converge on the debut album from violinist and songwriter Marquise Tolliver. He'll play live in the studio. That does it for today's show. Join us again tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.